This is Caravan to Midnight, the John B. Wells program. Here is John B.
All right, we now resume. You had a little bit more to say about Massey.
Massey was charged with felon in possession of firearms, and Kevin and I have been talking even as recently as this morning, since before this all happened, and he developed he read the law that he was charged with, and the government misrepresented it to the grand jury and in court. The law basically reads anybody who sends or transports or receives in any way in an effect in commerce, has been in an effect in commerce. Now, has is, I don't remember the grammatical thing, but it's fairly immediate, just out of, instead of had, which would be any time in the past. So he developed what's called the has-had argument. And he's filed his appeal, and it's based on primarily on the has-had argument. The wording of the law, you know, we're talking about the persecution by government. If the law says has been in an effect in commerce, grammatically, does that mean it you received it out of commerce or that it's been in commerce somewhere along the line? But the pattern jury instructions for the Fifth Circuit, where his appeal will go, the pattern jury instruction said if it's ever been in commerce rather than has been. Now, if government has control over commerce when things crossed interstate lines, do they lose that control when it's sold and resold within a state or not? And that's the whole issue, that there might be thousands or tens of thousands of people in prison right now that shouldn't be there because the government has misrepresented the wording enacted by the Congress of the United States, the legislatures. The judicial branch is changing what the words of the law are. And if, you know, if we're a nation of laws, that wording is specific and it has to be taken as it was written. And so this is going to be interesting when he finally gets to the appellate court as to whether has been in an effecting commerce means what it says or what the judicial branch of government wants it to mean. And I wanted to get that point because, you know, the government is in Burns in Nevada and in all these cases that I cover, the government is conducting what I call lawfare. It's warfare, but the battlefield, rather than being a battlefield, is actually the courtroom where they've got all the rules. They control all the plays. They control most of the people, including the bar attorneys to some extent. And, you know, it's one way, Massey, the guy's got courage. He's willing to go to prison to fight this battle and try and change the law or the interpretation of the law. And, you know, the guy deserves a lot of respect. He is suffering. He's got close to 2 years now that he's been in custody from when this first began. And you know, it's people like that that are willing. Now, when we talk about Burns in Nevada, we'll get into the same thing. People that are willing to stand up short of warfare and deal with the lawfare and fight the government back on their own terms on the government's playground, hoping to prevail, is probably the only way to, you know, get back to where we're supposed to be.
Let me ask you this, and this man, this is an obvious one, right? But there's been an awful lot of this in recent years. I mean, the whole deal with Waco, that was like 20 years ago, you know, over. But it is amazing to me how transparent the motives are. I mean, I just saw a thing on RT, and I mentioned it before you came on, that there's an F-18 Super Hornet sitting there. And it's painted up in Russian colors, Russian camouflage, little Russian red stars on it. But down there by the engines, it says Marines, just like it does on a regular, Marine aviators aircraft. Uh-huh. You know, between Qatar and the Saudis funding ISIS, you know, between leaflets being dropped telling the truck drivers, abandon your trucks, there's going to be an airstrike in about 10 minutes. You know, and stuff like
after
this.
After the highway of death in Kuwait.
Yes, highway of death. And then you look at what's going on here domestically, and it just seems like we're just awash in disinformation and propaganda.
Well, the propaganda, the fifth column is telling us is one thing, and their objectives are what's hidden and are being exposed. Eric Snowden and Julian Assange deserve the Medal of Freedom, not jail, for exposing these things. But see, they're breaking the bubble too, just like mainstream media and the Republican Party inadvertently are destroying themselves as far as their image in the public. These two guys... And I'm going to throw Massey in there, too, are taking the challenge. They're willing to take the risk inherent in exposing the corruption in government. Everybody in politics wants a one-world government, as long as they can be masters. And so what we're looking at is they're creating a worldwide oligarchy, or they're trying to create a worldwide oligarchy. And probably the biggest obstacle to that is the Constitution of the United States of America.
Well, that is the obstacle. Absolutely. I mean, you know, if we were under a monarchy, it'd be one thing. We tick the king off. We tick the queen off. That's not good, because the king or the queen, they make the rules. That's it. They are the law. But that's not the way it's supposed to be here. What I wonder, and maybe it's easier than it seems like it would be, but I do wonder how they get so much cooperation out of the officers in these various departments in the field. I guess it's the old, I was just following orders routine.
Well, if let's go back to what I mentioned earlier, that they're appointing political appointees in charge of these departments, and they have a lot of control. They can recommend the removal of a general because he won't go along with the game plan because he's a military man and he thinks that we ought to fight a war like it's a war. So it's easy once you take control of those elements of government to manipulate and misrepresent what you're doing when you get rid of good people and promote the bad people that are yes men.
So you got political officers in there just like the old Soviet Union.
Right.
A political officer.
But here it's probably, I wrote one article, I guess a year or two ago, called What Happens When You Turn Congress Over to the Market Forces. And it talks about lobbyists and how the congressmen, when they get contributions to their reelection campaign, will favor whoever the lobbyist is representing. And in that case, we're talking about $30 million from an Indian tribe that wanted to have exclusive rights to have gambling ships on a river. The same thing applies here in this country. In Russia, I don't know if money was a factor or just kissing ass, pardon the expression, was a factor. But in this country, money's the factor. So if you make the campaign contributions or at least make a significant commitment to getting somebody elected or reelected, then you're in for the political favor of an appointment. And if you impress them enough, you can be head of the Department of Defense. Now, they have to get an attorney in for the Department of Justice, but that's the only office that requires some degree of qualification. And, you know, I don't have a whole lot of respect for bar attorneys anyway, because what we're seeing in Burns, Oregon, is the reluctance on the part of the standby attorneys to submit the motions that some of the players want to submit. Now, with Shauna Cox, her attorney has finally submitted and is really put in everything that Shauna has asked her to put in. Some of them were frivolous, and some are quite valid. But bar attorneys can – I know two attorneys, John can't think of his name right now, down by Sacramento, down in Placer Country. And there was a guy up in Washington that lost their bar cards because they challenged within the rules, but began challenging the court, the law versus the Constitution. Now, I said law, but really the rules of court are the most damaging thing. They're worse than the laws because of the amount of discretion that's given to the judge in a trial. And we're seeing that in Burns right now. And another aspect of that is, well, something I've said for years. I learned this back in the 90s, that the rules of court make an unfair playing ground if the judge wants to be honest. Now, in Hannon's case, in Massey's case, Hannon is honest, but he's bound by Fifth Circuit precedents. But in California, when the referendum approved the marriage between a man and a woman, a federal judge, now in California, a referendum, if it passes, becomes a part of the California Constitution, making it one of the largest constitutions in the world. But a federal judge comes back and deems it unconstitutional. Now, Article 4, Section 4 guarantees every state the Republican form of government. And since the federal government is not authorized to get involved in marriage at all, how can a federal judge say that an amendment to the California Constitution is unconstitutional? You know, rules of the court allow these things to occur outside, but Hannon had to stick by the precedents. He stuck by what he was bound by in finding Massey guilty. And when I get this next article out, the case of Kevin Casey Massey, the dialogue from some of the court proceedings is in there, and you can see that Hannon felt bad finding Massey guilty. He says it, and he's looking forward to it going to the Fifth Circuit on appeal. So some judges are honest and stick to a moral responsibility and a legal responsibility, and others are dishonest and do whatever they want. You know, the judicial system, the lawfare playing field is so imbalanced unless the judge has integrity, and I don't think there are that many that do, that, you know, it's an uphill battle. Can we win it? I hope so.
You know, I was looking at this thing. I was looking at this thing earlier about the how Iceland dealt with the bankers and so forth. I mean, they sent some of those guys to jail for a while, and one of them's been in there. They've added a little more to his sentence. This started in April, I guess, of last year, if I remember correctly, and I may not. But anyway, now we've got people out there saying things like U.S. elections to be canceled and war crimes tribunals to be held, Pentagon and CIA sources say. I wonder if the Pentagon sources, for their part, say the 9/11 law will push Saudi Arabia to expose Israel, Bandar bin Sultan, and the Bush cabal behind 9/11, and will lead to a real truth commission and a war crimes tribunal. And the data dump of over 1 million documents reveals the extensive crimes of the Clinton Foundation, making it clear there's a powerful faction within the military-industrial complex that's fighting to overthrow the Khazarian mafia. I mean, if only this were true. And that's Ben Fulford. That's an article. By Ben,
the World Court in the Netherlands, the United States says, well, we'll listen to them if we want to, and if not, we won't. And I think a few years ago there was an indictment, I forgot who it was for, but some American dealing with war crimes. And, you know, the debate the other night, Hillary Clinton talked about the five-year-old from Aleppo. She didn't talk about the weddings that have been destroyed and the innocent people killed by the administration in Afghanistan, and especially Afghanistan, but some in Iraq as well, that the collateral damage, the nice warm word that we use, collateral damage, they pick and choose what they want to demonstrate. You know, if we cause it, we blame it on collateral damage. If somebody else causes it, it's a war crime. And I don't understand the difference between an entire family and their friends destroyed by a strike against a wedding because they thought it might have been an Al-Qaeda meeting or something, versus a boy that was, you know, when we look at Dresden and Hiroshima and Nagasaki, a five-year-old boy that's all bloody when he comes out of Aleppo because the Russians or the Syrians, somebody fired a missile there. And, hey, I wouldn't doubt if it was our missile, quite frankly, but because we don't get the truth. And that's the problem. If there was a true tribunal that could try war crimes and would investigate and have the authority to subpoena and to punish anybody who didn't respond or perjured themselves, we might get somewhere. But the United States runs the show. We fund the United Nations. I think we pay over half of their bill, and we're just one country. We buy favors from Saudi Arabia and all these. Why do we send them billions of dollars every year? You know, it's buying favoritism. We've sure. protected the Shah of Iran after he got ousted. But we took the two most westernized countries in the Middle East, Libya and Iraq, you know, where people walked around in civilian clothes. Ladies showed their faces, their arms, and their legs, not just their ankles, but their whole legs. And we went after those countries when they walk around in robes to their toes and hijabs on. We don't attack those countries. It makes... You know, it just reeks of 1984. You know, they used to be our enemies, now they're our friends, and it seems to me we used to be friends with them, but now they're our enemies. Our enemies seem to be the people that have adopted our culture more than our friends, but they just are not playing the game of obedience to the United States for all the money they receive.
All right, well, I wonder what we can mess with next, Gary. You know what I mean?
Well, I think that, you know, what I said after Waco, there was a church up in Montana, Church Universal and Triumphant. Claire Prophet was the head of that church, and she had some tanks and some artillery and things like that. And when I'd been informed of this when I left, during and when I left Waco, and I thought that the civil war in this country was going to break out. I'm not sure what the government did, but they gave her they bought back all this harsh military equipment from her, and she just all of a sudden got quiet. She was very much against the government, but something seduced her into compliance. But then, you know, we've all heard about civil disobedience. This goes back a couple hundred years. What about civil defiance? What happened? The first civil defiance happened in Washington, D.C., when they closed the World War II Veterans Memorial, and the people said, this wasn't waving signs in the street. They said, we're going to take these barricades, and we're going to throw them against the White House fence. That was civil defiance, not disobedience. The Bundy situation in April 2014 was civil defiance. What happened in Burns, Oregon was civil defiance. Now, civil defiance is an escalation from civil disobedience. It's going to work in forcing the government back into the Constitution, or it's not going to work. And I don't know what the next step is, but I'm guessing it would be a war for restoration of constitutional government. And I think it's quite possible that if we have the integrity of the founders and the integrity of our heritage and a belief in our Constitution and our what should be and what was way of life, that shedding blood to restore that is as worthwhile now as it was 240 years ago.
Well, I wonder how many people are actually on the same page. To look at television, to look at the stuff that's, I mean, the print is not that big anymore because it's, you know, it's going online. It's a lot cheaper. I'm pretty sure about that. But, in fact, I'm absolutely sure about that. But I just wonder how many people really feel the way that you do and the way I do and the way, you know, people that we talk to feel about it. I wonder if the citizenry is ready for this. I mean,
I wrote two articles that address that. One is called The Other Not-So-Thin Line, and the other one is called Factions. Now, The Other Not-So-Thin Line, we've been looking at left and right, and constitutional or unconstitutional, but it occurred to me a few years ago that there's another perspective we need to look at here. And so The Other Not-So-Thin Line, without regard to politics or ideology, begins on the left and goes towards the right. Back until Waco, the people that had joined that thin line were basically the anti-IRS people, were abused by the Internal Revenue Service. Come Waco, we got a big surge of input coming onto the line because of what happened in Waco. That died out after the Oklahoma City bombing, pretty much dwindled down to just a small flow. But then in 2007, 2008, we had a really big surge come in on the Patriot side in the Tea Party movement. Now, whether they consider themselves patriots or not, they are objecting to government as it is. And that's what all these elements that move people onto that line emulate from. So we had a big surge come in 2008. The problem is it brought the mean way back down. When you take the average of these people, it's going shifted way back to the Tea Party people. But as we move along that line, we become more intolerant of the abuses of government and more excited to do something. Now, you know, I don't know what the terminal end of the right side of the line is, but it's restoration of constitutional government. But by what means is the question. But again, from disobedience to defiance to the next step, as people move along that line, they begin to realize that the failure of the process they've been trying. They keep moving further and further along that line. Now, the other article that's kind of a horizontal look at the Patriot community. The vertical look at the Patriot community is called factions. And as long as the principal faction is restoration of constitutional government, we've got all these people in these diverse groups, different factions. Kick them all out in the Federal Reserve, regardless of what it is. They have to be subordinate to the restoration of constitutional government. And once these people recognize that the ultimate goal is that and all the other problems are resolved when we restore constitutional government, then they have moved significantly further along that line. There are a lot of factions, however, that cannot be included or incorporated into the principal faction of restoration of constitutional government, and they're identified in the same article. So I've listed a number of the factions that can be a part of and those that can't be a part of to give a more vertical looking down on perspective of the Patriot community. And, you know, this is after, you know, 20 years involvement, really 30 if we go back to the IRS days, 1981. But if we understand where we're going, is it easier? If we know what the roadmap is it easier to achieve the goal? And I think so, which is why I wrote those two articles.
What do you think about the upcoming election here? You know, people get
the same group. If Hillary gets elected, it's time to pick up our rifles. If Donald Trump gets elected, we're going to have to wait from January to June to find out if he's really going to do what he said he's going to do. And if he doesn't, then it's time to pick up the rifles.
You're talking rifles here, yeah?
Yeah, I am. And let's go back to Waco. On April 19th, I don't know how many radio programs I was on that day. I spent almost the entire day on the radio with different, I think, 10 or 12 different programs. And I think in every one of the programs, I said, I am at war with the United States government. It's a cold war now, but someday it will turn hot. I don't see any alternative. We either win the cold war or we go to a hot war. And, you know, my willingness to give my life for my country, what I believed in at the time, I get involved in the anti-war movement within a year of my returning from Vietnam, but you know, I was an American. I believed in that. I was a baby boomer and I was raised in that beautiful era of the 1950s. I mean, that was America. The American dream was really existent then. A father could support a family of a wife and three children in almost any job. The nickel candy bars cost a nickel then. Now they cost $2. The buying power, nothing else has gone up. You know, the wages have only minimum wage has gone from a buck and a quarter to eight. Even if it goes to 15, that's going to be about 11 times what it is. But the cost of goods has gone up 10 to 20 times what it was. So, you know, it's an uphill battle. It's just like the stock market. A couple of years ago, I wrote an article when we hit a record. I think it was when we crossed the 15,000 point market. But then I looked at the purchasing power of the dollar, and really, we hadn't made any gains. That was, that was back in the 70s. When we look at purchasing power, it was back in the 70s that we had crossed that $15,000 mark when we adjusted to purchasing power. So, you know, there's a big deception going on. Why do nickel candy bars cost $2 today? I can't answer that except it's a form of taxation. Inflation, if the government needs more money, they print it. It's like splitting stocks. When you split stocks, they go to half the value. But they do that because now there's room for it to move up again, and generally it does. But with the dollar, when they split the dollar, the purchasing power goes down because we've got all these dollars out that the government's buying favors with, whether it be domestic or foreign. And it's got to be accounted for, so that reduces our purchasing power significantly every time inflation steps in. Inflation is not a good thing.
Do you see a push toward World War III? Well, would these people really take us into World War III to save their sorry backsides?
I think our government is belligerently intimidating and threatening people, which may result in World War III.
Yeah, if they treat their own citizens like the way that they do, why wouldn't they treat foreign countries that way too?
That's it, but now they're trying to lay the blame on Russia for starting World War III if they start shooting down American aircraft. But see, we're supposed to be fighting ISIS, I think. That's what I've been told back to 1984. We're supposed to be fighting ISIS, but instead we bomb the Kurds and we bomb the Syrian forces. We support the Syrian rebels who are in bed insuring equipment with the ISIS. And, you know, these recent emails are beginning to expose that. Who supports ISIS? Saudi Arabia. And who supports Saudi Arabia? We do. Why? Since I think 90%, over 90% of the people involved in September 11th were from Saudi Arabia. So we go after Afghanistan and Iraq, and Iraq had nothing to do with it. Mm-hmm. How do you put these pieces together? It's a complex puzzle, but, you know, just at a quick review of all the circumstances, there's something desperately wrong with what the government is telling us and what they're actually doing. And we'll look at the start of World War One. French Archduke, whatever his name was, you know, that assassination was the little spark. The sinking of the Lusitania got us involved. Then World War Two, you know, the German encroachments into the appeasement policy and Germans encroachments into Poland and various places, and finally it struck a chord, and England said no more after they invaded France. And then we didn't get involved until Pearl Harbor, but you know, I have no doubt that Roosevelt, who wanted to help Churchill, his buddy, did what he could to try and lay the groundwork for that to happen so we could justifiably jump in the war. Little incidents, though, can grow in magnitude rapidly and result in large-scale war. And the way the government is acting, if they stop making foreign payments, I imagine the war would start and we'd be surprised which side some of our friends would be on. So it seems that money right now is the catalyst in keeping a peaceful world. But something's going to push it over the edge unless our government stops meddling in nation building. And they don't call it that because we always appoint the Shah of Iran or, you know, if when we go back to Iraq, we wrote the Constitution, said sign here, they did, and that Constitution had everything subject to review by an American advisor. We're nation builders, we just don't call it that. We do it by proxy, and that proxy better abide. Look at Afghanistan, I can't think of the guy's name right now, but he's beginning to defy us. Things ain't working right. And so, you know, he'll be assassinated or something will happen and they'll try and replace. And we can go back to Vietnam. I think it was Diem that was, you know, he was Vietnam and we didn't like that. So let's assassinate him and put somebody else in.
Then they got his brother about 6 months later, didn't they, in L.A.?
Yeah, well, that's the government's way of dealing with problems, get rid of them. And that's the Russian way, too, in the what country was it? The killing fields.
Yeah.
Thailand or whatever. Well, you Cambodia. Get rid of the problems.
Cambodia,
the
purges. Yeah, I think that was Cambodia.
Cambodia, that's right.
Yeah.
And the killing fields. And so you get rid of the enemy. And we're peace-loving people, and we don't like blood. So in this country right now, it doesn't matter if you demonstrate by burning cars, turning over police cars, burning buildings, robbing everything out of a store, you're not criminal. But if you occupy, if you protect your cattle or occupy a government building, boy, you're criminals now, and we want to put you away for half the rest of your life. And they use divisive means, too. I mean, when we get into talking about Burns, I want to talk about this terrorism enhancement that they've threatened people with, which forced them to go into plea agreements. And I know that Ryan Payne is right now reconsidering his plea agreement in Oregon and is probably going to go pro se in Nevada. And John Ritzheimer is possibly these are people I know. So I when I do stories, I have to have some inside contact. And John and Ryan are two of them. Shauna Cox is another. John Ritzheimer is thinking is drawing his plea now because he knows he was lied to by his own attorney. Both of them were lied to by the attorney regarding the terrorism enhancement.
Terrorism enhancement. Can you break that down a little bit here? The hell is terrorism enhancement?
Enhancement. federal sentencing guidelines allow enhancements. And Scalia made an interesting comment in one of the Supreme. There have been numerous Supreme Court decisions on terrorism enhancement. I'm sorry, the sentencing guidelines. And Scalia made an interesting statement. He said, "We established the guidelines to take away the discretion of the judge, and in the process, we removed anything that would take that discretion away from the judges." And so what they decided in that decision, numerous decisions, actually the first one I ran into had to do with the Branch Davidians and the enhancement that was given by the judge who said they used automatic weapons, so I'm adding 15 years to their sentence. And David, one of them took it to the Supreme Court, and it was one of the first rulings on the sentencing enhancement. But what the court finally resolved on is only the jury can determine an enhancement. And if it's not done at trial, then it would have to be done in a separate sentencing hearing and the decision in the hands of the jury. But what they did in Burns is they threatened these people, terrorism enhancement, and the standby or the court-appointed attorneys were carrying this message from the USA's assistant United States attorneys to their clients saying the government's going to impose a terrorism enhancement and that'll mean 30 years for you. So if you're convicted, you're going to get 30 years. But wait, there's no charges in Burns that have anything to do with terrorism. Therefore, the jury can't find a guilt or on terrorism, so the enhancement can't apply because the jury has to make the determination. So they got lied to as pressure to reduce the number of people that are willing to fight the government. And this is what Ryan Payne especially recognizes now. You know, I sent him my article, he read it, and he begins to understand now that his attorney lied to him in Oregon and actually helped the government pressure him to take a plea agreement. So the terrorism enhancement can't be applied unless the initial charge is terrorism, unless they come back at sentencing and somehow try and justify a terrorism enhancement. But they can't be found guilty first time of a terrorism enhancement because there is no terrorism in any of the eight charges against them. Seven now because they dropped the violence one.
They dropped the violence one.
Yeah, I think it was count three in Burns' act of violence. Let me see if I can find that indictment. There was an act of violence charge against them, and it was dismissed, just like Shawna Cox on use of firearm. Too many papers on the desk.
Use
of a firearm, and that was, she was acquitted of that by the judge because the government did not have a case on it. But they just charged her, and it brings into question what was presented to the grand jury. Now, Shawna Cox tried to subpoena Catherine Armstrong. Catherine Armstrong was the FBI agent that signed the criminal complaint and then probably presented it to the grand jury. Now, in that criminal complaint, she said that Shawna Cox had a firearm. She also said John Retzheimer was there on the day that he was at the Safeway, and I don't recall the circumstances. I wrote an article about it, John Retzheimer and the grand jury, but he was supposed to have been there on such and such a day. I don't recall what day it was, but John's wife provided me credit card receipts and messages that show your location. And John saying where he is, and he didn't get to Burns until 2 days after this event was supposed to have occurred. So Catherine Armstrong lied to the grand jury about John Retzheimer. She lied. That's perjury, I think. She lied to a grand jury to get an indictment. So now the grand jury makeup itself, when we began looking into it and the laws, the jury manual for Ninth Circuit is kind of ambiguous. It says district and division. Now, Burns is in the Pendleton Division. It's over on the east side of Oregon. But the grand jury was one. There were three grand juries held. Two of them had one person from the Pendleton Division, and the other one had two people from the Pendleton Division. The rest of them all came from the Portland Division. Now, the Portland is millennial city. You know, it's got these airheads that live with in their parents' basement. A gun to them is something that is outrageous unless it's in a movie or on a television program. And so the grand jury is made up of people that live in the Portland area on the west side of the Cascade Mountains. And is that a fair jury for people that are in ranching country where guns are a way of life?
Certainly not.
So the grand jury, and I don't have the numbers yet on the petite jury, but the petite jury appears at one point, it appeared that of the hundreds of people they had, again, it was weighted very heavily towards the Portland Division, not the Pendleton Division. So they're not being tried by a jury of their peers, nor are they satisfying the intent of the Constitution that requires the crime be held in the district in which the crime occurs. Now, back then, the districts, you know, low population and everything, the districts were significantly larger. But Oregon doesn't, both Oregon and Washington have one district. I think Nevada's one district, too. But they made divisions to accommodate the increase in population and the diversity of the population. So when we look at the divisions in Oregon, for example, there are divisions on the west side of the Cascades, and on the and they go by county line, sometimes cross the Cascades, but never get down the flatlands on the other side. And then we've got the eastern side that's got its divisions. Now, those divisions appear to satisfy the intent of the Constitution as far as with regard to the district in which it's held. And I guess a good analogy of that is, say, back in the 1860s, 1870s, if you stole a horse in Massachusetts, you'd be fined and restitution because it wasn't life-threatening. But if you stole a horse out west, they'd hang you by the nearest tree. The different cultures in different parts of the country have different considerations with regard to what's criminal and what's not, and to what degree something is criminal. if we look at the jury itself, the vicinage is the old English term for it, that in a jury trial and the grand jury, the judgment should be made by the people who determine what the significance of the crime, but more importantly, that the jury trial is to judge whether there's criminal activity or not, but also to judge how the government administers itself. But see, that's been removed completely now by the rules of the court, by all these rules and different things they've got. How can the people of Harney County evaluate how their government operates if the trial's held in Portland and the jury is composed of Portland people? How do we know if our local government is doing its job the way we expect them to do in a self-governed country, by the way, when that trial is held across the Cascades in a city format? So there's, and these are things that, you know, I didn't know until we started looking at the Burns trial and looked into, Shauna, we've got a team of people that's working primarily with Shauna, and we started looking into all these things, looking at the documents on record, the jury manual for the Ninth Division and everything, and it seems that they're going against their own rules. And Judge Anna Brown could care less whether there's justice in her courtroom as long as she can achieve the desired objective, and let's go back to a political appointee, yeah, of getting a conviction for the government of these unworthy people.
I'm just wondering if any kind of judicial oversight is even possible, because it seems to me that with every passing, I'm not going to say day, but certainly every passing year, all right, let's make it every passing quarter, there's some sort of a new wrinkle that is so contradictory as to the prosecution of actual law. It just seems, I mean, and this is an easy one. I'm sure I'm not the first one to say this. In fact, I'm totally sure of it. But they seem to make it up as they go along, and it seems to be driven politically. That was the whole idea, was to have, look, we have some laws. You can't drive it politically. It can't be driven politically. It's simply the law. But now it is driven politically, all the way up to the Supreme Court. These idiots are just falling all over themselves, trying to rush a liberal onto the Supreme Court roster, so that they can really have their way then. And you're right, at that point, a decision has to be made as to how we want to live, if we intend to be under the boot of the government and its whims, or if we want to be a free republic, a democratic republic, which was the original design. All this, it's a democracy, or a democracy. It's not a democracy. But it's beginning to look like one, because it looks like, since there are far more idiots out there than bright people, it's beginning to look like the idiots are actually running things. So this, in fact, may be truly a democracy, and if that's the case, then it's doomed.
Yeah, it is, because the limitations on government that were part of what Jefferson called the chains, the Constitution being the chains that bind the government, those chains have disappeared completely at this point. It's a facade to make us believe that they still exist. Let's look back to the 1780s. There was something called the Boston Massacre, where the British soldiers, the king's own soldiers, fired on people and killed five of them. They stood trial. They were acquitted. Actually, two were convicted, and they took the something of the church where if they could cite a quote from the Bible, they'd be branded on their thumb rather than convicted. But they were convicted of, I think it was manslaughter. Every once in a while, the government throws a cop to the dogs that shot somebody. And you know, with this day, everybody's got a video camera in their phone. There's enough proof that they've got to throw more and more to the dogs. But when was the last time over something significant, say the FBI that shot at the truck before, right after Lavoie got out, and then the OSP that shot Lavoie later, the OSP trooper that shot at the truck three times when it was coming down the road towards the blockade, the shot that was fired at Ryan Payne at the first stop, Waco, the deaths in Waco, the guys go, any event, Donald Scott. How come these people don't stand trial? How come the government judges itself with regard to whether there's criminal activity or not on the part of government? There was a guy that I met in Las Vegas when I was traveling around, and he gave me a book, and I don't have it anymore. But he looked at the decade of the 80s and how many hundreds of killing of unarmed people by Las Vegas Police Department or the Sheriff's Department. And at the inquest, it was determined justifiable homicide. One guy was pulling out his cell phone. The other guy just pulled his hands out of his pocket and was shot. All these stories that he had in there, and they're deemed justifiable homicide because the government is judging itself as far as whether there's any criminal activity. That's not what happened 240 years ago when these guys stood trial for killing people in Boston. But it happens here. Nobody was tried over Waco to see. How can the people judge how their government's doing if these people aren't being judged by the people themselves? But the government has stolen that away from the right of the people. They've taken the grand jury that used to turn against government as often as it indicted people. And now the government, the grand juries are headed by the district attorney or the state attorney or the U.S. attorney, and they're told you can do this, you can't do that. In fact, during Waco, when we looked in the grand jury down there, it was kind of interesting that if the grand jury comes back with a true bill, the AUSA down there, or the USA, the United States attorney down there, can quash the true bill. Now, true bill should turn to an indictment at the will of the people, but the USA can say no, it's not going to be an indictment. So the government has taken absolute control over the evaluation of its methods. It's taken it away from the people and keeps it safely behind their hired minions. So there is no justice. Justice has disappeared in this country, or properly, as said by the government, just us.
Unbelievable. Well, this is the thing that, frankly, it gets a little bit wearying. I feel pretty sure that people have mentioned the Boston Massacre several times since it happened, and in the years that have passed between the day it happened and our conversation today. And yet, things appear to have changed, not really very much at all. And I just wonder if there's any, you know, the Greeks were always talking about what makes the old Greek philosophers were talking about always writing and discussing, you know, what makes a happy life, what makes a sincere life, what makes a good life, and what makes a good society, you know. And I mean, we're still wrestling with the same damn problems. We really are. It seems really as though we've made no progress. And
well, it's changed since then because, you know, I read the proceedings of the trial. You know, they weren't accurate like we have today where you've got transcripts of what was said, but generally reports by people that attended the trial. And these people stood trial because some people died. So let's judge it. Now, we're not there anymore. But clearly, when you read the entire thing, these guys were scared for their lives. They were surrounded by people. They were throwing snow. They were throwing blocks of ice, and they were throwing stones and sticks at these people. And so you've got, you know, eight guys out there, and they're surrounded by about 40 people. That can be awful scary if all you have is your bayonet, and they're actually covering three sides of you. So yeah. Those guys were determined by the jury trial, by the local people, not by the government, that with the exception of two of them, they were not guilty. We don't have that today. There is no evaluation. So the use of force back then, the rule in Boston at the time was they were not to discharge their weapons without a command from a senior officer, and the captain did not meet that criteria. Captain, whatever his name was, that was part of it, yeah, was not authorized to say you can fire. So there were rigid rules on firing, and now that discretion is left with the fucking cop. I'm sorry, the cop at his discretion whether he can shoot or not, and he'll justify it in the end by saying, I feared for my life.
Yeah.
So we're not even close to that. Then they couldn't do it, and if they did, they stood trial. Now they can do it, and they don't stand trial. You know, they just get off. What was it up in Maryland? The five guys got off on that. Now, I don't know all the circumstances of that. I haven't looked into it, but at least they stood trial. But I'm sure that the jury instructions that the government puts out aren't necessarily going to express the wording of the law with regard to determination of innocence or guilt. And there's an argument going on now as far as jury instructions that are going to be given to the jury in Burns. Because the same thing, they're saying, if you did this. Now, let's get to an interesting one. The first charge, 18 U.S. Code 372, written in 1864 or something like that, where they didn't, or 1862, somewhere during the Lincoln administration, where anybody who impeded an officer could be charged and kept him from doing his duty or something. And I've got an article on it that goes in the wording and the detail and the history of that statute from then to now. But it was to officers. Now, what is an officer? Now, interestingly, let's go to Oklahoma City. The indictment for Timothy McVeigh had 8 cases of murder and 160 cases of what I call collateral damage. 8 people, he was charged with murdering 8 people. All of them were officers, and their titles were preceded by special agent. So they were officers. They had a degree of authority. They weren't employees. The rest of the people, whether civilians or employees, regardless, they were just collateral damage. They were people that died under a different charge, died as a result of him exploding a weapon of mass destruction or a truck bomb. So the distinction between officer and employee was made in 1994, 95, whenever that trial was. 96, when, no, it would, it was after 95, 96, 97, whenever that trial was, it was clear that officers were distinct from employees. Because obviously there were more than 8 government employees receiving a check from the government in that office. So in Burns, they're charged with threatening or intimidating and keeping an officer from performing his duty, but the government is coming back and saying that officer includes employees. But they've not, let's see, if I robbed a bank and you charged me with robbing a bank and I said, what bank did I rob? And you said, I don't know what bank you robbed, but we know you robbed a bank. Well, that doesn't hold water, does it? So let's say I impeded an officer. Well, what officer did I impede? Well, we don't know what officer you impeded, but you impeded an officer.
Yeah.
But they haven't brought anybody on the stand to say how. What we do know is on December 30th, this is according to a newspaper article by Carly Brousseau of Oregonian, I think, where she had done some interviews, and the guy that was spokesman for the Fish and Wildlife Service, and it was primarily FWS, not BLM, but the Fish and Wildlife Service, said that at the close of the working day on December 30th, we told people to go home and not come back until we told them it was okay to come back. Now, who impeded them from doing their job? Mm-hmm. Their boss telling them, go home and don't come back until we tell you to come back? Or did these people that went into the refuge keep them from doing their job? Which one? I mean, I'm going to listen to my boss if I want my job. And if he says, don't come back until I tell you to, I ain't going to do it. So how could these people possibly have done it? But the jury instruction isn't going to look at it that way, nor is it going to distinguish between an officer and an employee. So this is subversion by the court, by the judge, in not allowing the truth, the truth about the law and the truth about the facts to come out in court. Or at least to the extent of my knowledge, those facts have not come out. The jury has not been presented those two facts.
So now what?
Well, this case is fraught with appeal. Interestingly, the land that the Mahar Reserve was on was bought back by the government. It left 432. Ammon Bundy and I had a number of conversations back in November. He says the government can't own land, and I say the government can own land. You know, at this point, we finally got a title search on it, a chain of title search on it, and the land had left 432, which is territorial or government-owned land initially. It goes into the public domain, or the private domain. It was owned by ranchers and transferred back and forth for years. And then the government came and bought two parcels back, and those two parcels are where the buildings stand that were taken over by the occupiers. Now, the statutes, 40 U.S. Code 3118, I think it is, or 3112, says that if land comes back to the government, the jurisdiction remains where it was unless that jurisdiction is ceded, and it requires the filing of a notice of acceptance by the federal government with the local authorities to show that that land, that the jurisdiction has come back to the federal government. So right now, the federal government has no jurisdiction on the Malhara land. None at all. So why is this being tried in federal court since the crimes occurred on jurisdictionally state lands, state and county lands, state and county jurisdictions? And that's in the law, but Shauna was willing now let me go back to Ammon. Ammon said they can't own land, but they do all over the country. And what we found in the title report is the United States government in the 30s and 40s bought this land back or traded land for the land that the buildings sit on. So the deeds on record in the county records show the United States government as owner, and they also preclude any challenges because the previous owners relinquished with the deeds their rights to the land. So there is nobody that can challenge the government's ownership of the land. Nobody has standing to say you can't own that land. And this is, you know, one of Ammon's misconceptions on this. Not landscaper, which you said during the course of this, but surveyor, you know, that we look through the tube and say yes, no, and that stuff, land surveyor. But so the government had no jurisdiction there, but they did own the land. But they owned the land just as if you or I would. Now, if you or I had a problem like they wouldn't let my employees go to work on my property, I would go to the local sheriff, or if necessary, I'd go to the state to deal with the problem. I couldn't go to the federal government, and the federal government has no more right to go to the federal government to resolve a legal issue on that land than you or I would have. It's called jurisdiction, and it's been established throughout the history of this country. And Ammon's right. If they bought the land back, then they would have to get ceding from the state of Oregon, giving them partial or full jurisdiction back. There are a lot of places where some jurisdiction remains with the state and other jurisdiction goes to the federal government when it's ceded back. But the government's gotten lax in their doing that. Probably during the Depression, you know, they acquired so many things for various projects that they just were not going to bother with that anymore. But the fact is they did not follow the legal letter of the law with regard to them obtaining judicial jurisdiction on those lands. So, you know, this throws everything out the window in a sense. I don't know if the Mra building was ceded back to the government or always retained by them or not. I have no idea what the circumstance is on that. But the thing is, the government is saying that we have jurisdiction wherever we want, whenever we want. And this goes back to Massey, too. Massey was on private land. And the federal government had no jurisdiction. In fact, the statutes in the Texas penal and administrative code say that jurisdiction exists only at points of entry and on the premises of those points of entry and other lands owned by the United States government. So they've, in writing, it says they have limited jurisdiction. So how can they charge Massey with possession of firearm on private property? Now, Texas law says 5 years after the completion of your sentence, you can own a firearm. It's a little more detailed than that, but what they do is they automatically give back your rights after 5 years after your parole, any part of the sentence is completed. So Massey had had for over 20 years the right under Texas law to possess a firearm. He was never on federal lands. And did the Texas legislature, were they so stupid they didn't know that they couldn't write a law in contradiction of the federal government? Or is the federal government wrong in that situation? Well, the federal government claims they're right. And that's the issue that Massey is fighting right now. This whole matter of jurisdiction, the government, and it goes back to Waco. You know, where did the government obtain jurisdiction over a church in Waco, Texas? You know, so even back then, one of the articles I wrote back then, the fax days, I had to keep them. Ken Varden made me cut them down to one page after a couple days because he was faxing out 800 copies every night on two fax machines, and it took all night to fax them out. And then the idea was that they would then get refaxed by other people. It's kind of the old method of push out information. Sure. So they were short, but there's one article in there that questions why the federal government had jurisdiction at this church in Waco, Texas.
And that's a good question.
By the Constitution, they don't have it.
Yeah. By the Constitution, they don't have it.
Right. They have to acquire it. Yes. The two ways. 432 is when they retain land, what was territorial land, and before it's disposed of by going into the private sector. The other one is when it's reacquired. So 432 is when it goes, they have the authority to make all needful rules and regulations. And then our 1817 gives them exclusive legislative jurisdiction. Those are the two times that they can have jurisdiction. So once it leaves the one, unless it comes back under the other, it's no longer under
the federal jurisdiction. You know, we got circuit courts, and we got district courts, and we got state supreme courts, and we got the Supreme Court of the United States and all that. But the court of public opinion may turn out to be the most powerful court of them all. Because yes. I'm thinking, you know, what is any actual judicial oversight possible? I mean, where is the highly protected, the very, very much protected, ethical cadre of legal scholars who really don't care? I mean, they're almost like well, the equivalent of being apolitical, but they people who will just sit there and go, look, this is the law. There's no real interpretation that's necessary, meaning let's see if we can find some way to spin it. This is just the law, and you guys broke it. That's all there is to it. Sort of like a Supreme Court of the Supreme Court of the rest of the courts, maybe the Sublime Court or the double secret Supreme of all Supremes Court, something, because there are too many people making too many laws from the bench, and then it takes the process is long and laborious, and
expensive. I mean, and expensive.
Yeah, I was going to say painstaking. You will take pains if you want to pursue this. It's in a lot of cases it's easier to just take a wrong decision and its consequences rather than spend everything you have and everything you're ever going to have to try and reverse a bad decision in a higher court. It's crazy, and it's wrong. So I'm just wondering, I mean, Gary, I'm pretty sure you've got an idea. Maybe you do know. What would be the way to get all of these courts under control?
Let's broaden the problem first. One aspect of that is the fact that what I call badgering, and I've run into it when I was a surveyor representing a client with regard to the government's right to take his land without cost in exchange for him developing versus buying the land from him. And they wanted to take it for free. We want to approve your development. And so this mountain of paperwork, the paper chase went back and forth. Now, in Burns, the paper chase has exceeded 1,400 docket entries. That's phenomenal. That's how many motions, answers, and sometimes just minute orders where the judge says something and it's recorded, but 1,400 of them. But the government's in a position to keep that paper, make that paper chase very expensive. For example, if you're going to the appellate court, I don't know what it is now, but back in the 90s and talking with attorneys, if I go to the appellate court, it costs $50,000. If I go to the Supreme Court, it costs $200,000 minimum. That's the minimum retainer.
Gosh.
So how can... And it is done because of all these motions. Your attorney's got to respond to everything they say or acquiesce to it. You know, if you don't answer, then this becomes prima facie. So it's a game that government can play over and over and over again to make things very expensive. The other one was doing some research a couple of years ago with some friends on some aspects of jurisdiction. There was an interesting case, I think it was in Idaho, it might have been in Utah, but basically the Supreme Court of I'm pretty sure it's Idaho, but I'll use that. The Supreme Court of Idaho, in their decision on a case where it was remanded back to them by the Supreme Court, said, we cannot enforce our own constitution because of the weight of the federal powers.
That's encouraging, isn't it?
It is. Now, Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution guarantees, the only guarantee in the Constitution, guarantees every state a republican form of government. So if it's not in conflict with the federal Constitution, not the apparent enactments of the federal government, because they haven't been challenged to the Supreme Court because of the expense or for whatever reason, if what the state does, back to the California marriage law, if the state does something that's their purview and has always been their purview, then the federal government has no right to say that you can't do it. But they do it all the time. And, you know, everybody knows what Roe versus Wade is. And one thing they overlook in Roe versus Wade, which is a rather interesting statement by, I think it was Brandeis in a dissenting opinion, he goes back to 1810 in Maryland, where they had passed the first abortion law. And then he points out that through the years, almost every state has adopted their own determination of what was allowed with regard to abortion within their constitution or within their statutes. And what he said about Roe versus Wade is, we have no justification at all to even consider this case before us, because that's the prerogative of the states. But people overlook that, and so now people want the Supreme Court to overturn Roe versus Wade, or they want them to sustain Roe versus Wade. So both sides are saying, well, the federal government's superior here. So we've been duped into believing in the superiority of the federal court. We've been duped, because that's not the way it was. And I can go through many cases that I've run across that make that quite clear. But then we've got Ashwander versus TVA, and again, Brandeis, in a concurring decision, told us what the rules that were adopted by the Supreme Court to determine matters before it, and they will not rule on the constitutionality except as a last resort. And if they rule on the constitutionality, they will make the ruling as narrow as possible. Otherwise, they defer to the statutes. And anybody who seeks a benefit of a statute is bound by the statute, meaning the whole damn statute. These things are laid out for us. That was 1936. Now, what is the solution to the problem? I really don't know. The Constitution is a little over 4,000 words. The Internal Revenue Code is millions of words. You know, how we got to this is beyond me. But the intention, and if we go back to, say, 1810, and especially after Marbury versus Madison, and now people misconstrue Marbury versus Madison, too, because they say, well, it give the power of the federal government to interpret the Constitution. No, it didn't. What he said, when there's a dispute between the executive branch and the legislative branch, it's logical that the third branch, the judicial branch, can make the determination of which was right. Otherwise, you've got a stalemate. And so their intervention in that had to do with those that situation of the federal, the executive branch disagreed with the legislative branch, which is right, which is wrong. 4,000 words didn't answer the question. So they took that into consideration. Now that's expanded to what the government's eventually moved into is judicial interpretation. And then nowadays, judicial activism, where what they think should be is. And then we've got 1872, Harvard or Yale, one of those, developed a concept called the case law method. And Teddy Roosevelt made a comment about it. He says it's very good in interpreting the law, but it has very little to do with justice. Now, the case law method says we don't have to go back to the Constitution every time we rule on something. What we just find other cases that have addressed that issue, and then we'll build upon those. So every time they make a decision based on previous precedents, previous decisions, what they're doing is stepping further and further away from the Constitution. And that's where we've finally got to what is referred to as judicial activism. Now, how do we solve this problem? That's a good question. If we abided by the Constitution, and maybe we need to go back, and I wrote a very extensive article, The Plan for Restoration of Constitutional Government, that kind of addresses it, that we go back to the laws as they existed July 4th, 1860. Because in 1861, the United States government blatantly violated the Constitution by allowing West Virginia to become a state in the Union, but they needed to have a quorum, so they did it. And it's in violation of the provision that if a state is made from parts of one state or parts of two states, it requires the consent of both the legislatures of those states to give consent to the creation of the new state. And West Virginia was chopped out of Virginia, and the Virginia legislature never consented to it. So if we go back to then, and then require every time a law is enacted that it provide the constitutional authority and go public with this information so the people see what the legislature is doing and how they try and twist it into obedience to the Constitution are in fact obedient to the Constitution is one thing. And, you know, requiring all the legislation. Now, the reason to go back to July 4th, 1860 is we've got tens of thousands of laws on the books, many of which are blatantly unconstitutional. So how do you get rid of them? Take them all out and then go back and look for the good ones and bring them back in. And it wouldn't hurt to do that. It would be a lot easier than spending 40 years trying to cull out the bad ones. Just sweep them all out and bring in back the good ones. But also it proposes a national grand jury where any government employee, if enough people sign a petition, that person can be impeached by the people. The government, the Constitution gave all the authority for punishment of people in government to the government itself. The House reviews the actions of the members of the House. The Senate reviews the actions of the Senate. The House and Senate together can impeach the officers of the judicial or executive branch of government. So all the power is retained at that top tier. And when it's retained at that top tier, if that top tier conspires to extend their authority, they're going to do it. And the people have no recourse. And so that has to be changed. One method would be the ability to pull a national grand jury, you know, with the grand jury members coming from separate states, and a petition to the grand jury to review the matter. Another one would be to punish people in government, which this used to happen, to punish them, and they can no longer hold office in the government if they violate their office. And there was an Elsie Hastings in Miami was impeached as a federal judge. He ended up being in Congress. He should never have been allowed to hold a position in Congress after he was impeached as a federal judge. But we're not harsh on them, and we're not even harsh on bad criminals. We're only harsh on the criminals who have victimless crimes. Murderer can get out in 5 years. A marijuana smoker might spend 20 years in prison.
That is interesting, isn't it?
It is. And so, you know, the solution, I think, is inherent in giving power to the people to remove people from office if there's sufficient support to do that. And the other one is to require that all laws enacted explain their relationship or their authority under the Constitution. I'm working on an article now, for example, in the National Firearms Act of 1934. And what they were using is tax to effect a social control. The tax and interstate commerce felon in possession of firearms. That should be the purview of the state. You know, if the gangsters are running Chicago and Chicago goes along with it, you know, that's too bad. The federal government has no standing in it. But with prohibition, they kind of extended their authority outside. But it was an amendment to the Constitution that gave them the power to extend that authority outside of their normal jurisdiction. So we have from that that jurisdiction can be, by a constitutional amendment, extended outside. But then how long did prohibition last? You know, it was a dismal failure. But now they've outlawed marijuana, heroin, cocaine, codeine, and all these other things without a constitutional amendment. So there, we see in that very simple act that they've assumed authority that they never had, and they realized when they enacted prohibition that it required an amendment to the Constitution. But administrative agencies now have become the rule. And they make these laws that are extra constitutional and applied against us, and we have no say about it. It should be the state's prerogative, as we've seen in Washington and Colorado, to say that casual use of marijuana is okay, or the medical marijuana states. Massey had a medical marijuana certificate from California where he lived before, but his probation was, or his pretrial release was revoked because he smoked a joint. It had nothing to do with the crime, but the state prerogative, back to Roe versus Wade, each state dealt what they did with abortion. The only time it became national was prohibition, but now it's become national because some bureaucrat sitting in a seat in Washington says you can't have toilets that use too much water to flush, and you can't use these light bulbs because I still can't figure out why we can't use those light bulbs.
You can use 260s, but not one, not 100.
Well, the decorative ones, you know, the vanity light bulbs, the big round ones, you can still use because they haven't come up with a fluorescent replacement for those yet, but they will.
I think the thing to do is just do what you want.
The federal needs to back off.
I think that basically these people need to just bleep off and leave us alone and just do what you want. And if there's a problem, well, then there's a problem. But otherwise, you know, if you have to keep up with every possible thing, they say that every person in this country, of course, that's a little bit of a stretch, but let's say the huge, overwhelming majority of people in this country, to the point that it's a ridiculously large majority, commit at least 3 felonies a day, every day, and they don't even know it.
Right.
Which means
you've read the book. I take it. I have too.
You know the old 1994 omnibus crime bill. Let me tell you what, folks. That damn thing is well over 3,000 pages. It's some really boring, intensive reading. But I got to tell that
was the one with cops on the street that I mentioned earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you are guilty of something right now.
Mm-hmm.
They can make a case for you being guilty of something right now. And
back to three felonies a day, though, as he pointed out in there, with the laws enacted against, say, RICO, it was intended against organized crime, which the Crime Control Act National Firearms Act of 1934 was directed at Dillinger and people like him.
Yeah.
But then they applied RICO against a dentist in Florida.
Yeah, Racketeering Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act. A dentist in Florida.
Yeah, and then the Hammonds were charged under a terrorism act. Now, that terrorism act, it required an intent to terrorize rather than just simple arson. And so the rehearing, the appeal on the sentencing, which the first judge felt reasonable, was overruled by the appellate court, and they're back now serving the remainder of their 5-year sentence, which is the minimum under the Terrorism Arson Act.
Yes.
But they're not terrorists. Nobody determined they were terrorists. But see, that the wording in that act was to counter terrorism.
Well, this nonsense started in the 80s with your terroristic threat, man. You called somebody up and said you're going to beat their ass, man. That's terroristic threat. It's like, what? I'm serious about this. I didn't do it, but he did it. But
look at weapons of mass destruction. The definition, if the government wants to go after you, can be just about anything.
A shot
bomb is a weapon of mass destruction, but a cruise missile is not.
Right. What was your first example? I talked to you.
Pardon me?
What did you say could be deemed a weapon of mass destruction?
A pipe bomb.
A pipe bomb. I said a shotgun. Yeah.
Well, I don't know that they've stooped that low yet. Maybe they have. I might have missed that. I only cover cases where I do have contact with the source.
Oh.
Director, in fact, whether Robert Beecher in Georgia, I made contact with his sister, William Wolfe, I knew before he got busted. Skylar Barbeau, I made contact through some friends, and we're talking now, and I'm working on some more articles on him. Massey, I knew before then. Bundy Ranch, I had access to Ryan Payne and Ryan Bundy. I went to Ryan Bundy for some questions and Ryan Payne for others. And in Burns, I even went up there for a few days. I was there when the shooting occurred, but I was in town when it happened. But I made the contacts I needed. So for the most part, I can go back like Donald Scott and cover that to some extent, but only to what was said. But when I cover a story, I've got to have access. In Waco, I was there. I was in contact with the Davidians that weren't inside Mount Carmel Center and weren't in jail. I don't even touch the story if I can't cover it completely.
Yeah. Truth will ultimately prevail where pains are taken to bring it to light.
Right.
To light, rather.
George Washington, Thurston, and whenever it was. Yes, and see, that was on the masthead when I began publishing my paper. And how do you get to the truth if you're just reading other people's articles? I could tell you an interesting story about a corporate United States. People talk about corporate United States, and that's bullshit. Pardon my expression again. But Randy Mack had a radio show, and he was going to have a guest on, and I won't mention her name, but he wanted me to interview with her. He respected my work, and he wanted me to interview with her regarding, you know, whether she was competent in the area she wanted to cover, which was corporate United States. And so during the course of the conversation, it lasted about an hour, I said, you've read the Act of 1871, haven't you? She said, well, yes. I said, the whole thing, do you have a copy of it? She said, well, no, I've read parts of it that I've gotten out of other articles. And I said, I thought you said you were a researcher. She said, I am. This is my work. I read what other people have written, but I write my own articles. And she considers herself a researcher because of that.
Ah.
And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the alternate media is like that. And I've just, you know, I've set my standards a lot higher than that. And I want to be considered a legitimate journalist. And that's why I've got to have access to the source to write a story. But that's a lot of the alternate media. It misrepresents the heck out of things. In fact, surprisingly, Chrissy Ann Hall, who claims to be a constitutional expert, says the federal government can't own property, but she can't show me where it says in the Constitution they can't own property. It says they don't have jurisdiction, but it doesn't say they can't own it. And we've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of instances of them owning land around the country that is not 432 or 1817, like the Mahar National Wildlife Reserve Refuge. So,
just to go back just a little bit. Whatever happened to Ron Cole?
He's an artist now, and he does some excellent work, primarily aircraft. He paints. I think it's digital. It might be both digital and handwork. You know, I told Ron Cole a long time ago, be careful about how you say things. I met him in Florida after Waco. We had lunch together, and then he went out, and I introduced him to some people. He went out and got well into the group and wrote his book. I don't recall the name of it now, but let's see. Sinister Twilight by Ron Cole. And we've been on and off touch with each other for a long time. I wrote a series about him when he got busted. And he got set up by the feds. No, we won't arrest you. And then they had the local sheriff arrest him when he walked out of the restaurant. And this has happened with Beecher and a number of people where they're told they won't be arrested, and then they get arrested. But the government can lie all they want, but if you lie to them, ask Martha Stewart what happens. He's doing fine now. He's married and has a son. And
what was their
doing
beef
this
with
painting.
What was their beef with them, Gary?
They claim that he had been talking to people of Middle Eastern descent regarding dealing with problems in this country, something to that effect. And now, Ron was a gun enthusiast. You know, when I met him, he was talking about all the rifles he had. His family was pretty well off, and he got a lot of money from them to buy these things and travel around the country and everything. He's a heck of a nice guy. I really like him, and I'm back in touch with him. Have been for, I guess, about 6 months now. We just ran across each other on Facebook, but he's kind of he wants me to be careful what I say when I talk with him. So I am. So he's interestingly, of the people that go to prison, when they come out, they have abandoned, and Ron only served 2 years. They have abandoned their ideology. The only person I know that was still as committed as he was before he went to prison was Emilio Ippolito in the Florida Common Law Court trial. And the Florida Common Law Court Outpost would find you the articles on my page. I testified in the trial, but his daughter, Emilio, and his daughter, Susan Mockdad, got me interested in law back in the mid-80s, and I learned a lot from them. But they deviated from what they learned, and it ended up getting them in prison. Susan died in prison. Emilio, when he got out, was in his 80s, and I called him after I found out he was out, and I talked to his wife, and she says, he's got to stop this. He's going to kill himself. And so I tried to talk him out of doing it, told him to leave it to the younger people. I don't know if he did or not. I don't know if he's still alive. But he's the only one that came out of prison fighting. Mm-hmm. Everybody else, Doug Karpa, it was Pilot Connection, I can't think of his name right now, Ron Cole, all these people, when they get out of prison, they've given up. They've dropped it. You know, it cost them too much. Yeah. And
I'm pretty sure that's what the authorities count on.
Pardon?
That's what the authorities count on, that you'll give up.
Right. And, you know, this goes back to the plea agreements. Rather interestingly, you know, I came to a realization one evening, so I wrote an article about it, to plea or not to plea. 240 years ago, some guys went to Philadelphia and others went to Boston. The politicos went to Philadelphia. The military types went to Boston. Now, in the military, you know, you want to live to fight another day. And during World War II, there were quite a few POWs that, when they were escaped or released, went back into the battle. The plea agreement, they were facing, John and Ryan at least, were facing 30 years in prison based on the lie being told to them about the terrorism enhancement. If they took a plea agreement, they'd get 2 or 4 years, and they would be back on the streets to fight another day. Now, Ammon Bundy, Shauna Cox, Ryan Bundy, and the others up there that are in court right now, they're the ones that went to Philadelphia. Their battlefield is the courtroom or the paperwork, the legal issues, as opposed to the military side, which is Ryan Payne and John Ritzheimer. And so we can see an analogy between what happened 240 years ago and this break. And so taking the plea agreement, they will be back on the streets and ready to fight regardless of the law if the fight comes. And the term might be short enough that they still retain the ideology. Whether they do or not is yet to be seen. But there's a definite distinction between those that want to fight on the paper fight and those that want to fight the bullet fight.
Mm-hmm. Well, when's your book coming out? Surely never. You're going to write one, or are you writing it every day when you go to your.
I've had a number of people say you ought to write a book, and I say I don't write books. I write articles. In fact, if you look at my articles, they're kind of, you know, it evolved out of Waco, but I write snapshots of a story.
Yeah.
On Massey's, the article I'm writing now, I'm tying it together to some extent, but just primarily the legal battle and the reason for that in the article that I'm writing on the Firearms Act is we want to get some amicus curiae, the GOA, NRA, Jews for the Preservation of Firearms, and other gun organizations to perhaps join as friends of the court and assist Cowan, Philip Cowan, his attorney, because I don't know that Cowan can do that good a job. He's old. He had some health problems recently, and it would sure be nice if he had some big gun support from other entities that would be involved in a legal battle to rewrite the interpretation of the felon in possession law. But as far as writing a book, three or four people have said it should write a book. I said, I'll tell you what, you know, I'll give you all my files. You write the book, you tie it together. But I'm busy now, especially with Bundy Ranch, all these things that I've got going right now. I don't have time to write a book. When I did the harassment of the Hammonds, now most people think of the fires, but for 20 years prior to the first fire, the Hammonds were being hassled by the government. And early on in the early 80s, Dwight Hammond said, they're trying to take my land away from me, and they still are. And that's demonstrated by the fact that in the final judgment, the government got put in there the $400,000 fine that had to be paid. And fortunately, and to the chagrin of the government, was paid. And then if they decided to sell the land, the government had the right of first refusal. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to take his land. He was right 20 years, two decades prior. But, you know, 700 pages in erratic order, I had to sort it chronologically. I probably got 300 hours in writing that series, Harassment of the Hammonds, which goes through those 20 years. And the government's own admissions in their private files, things the Hammonds have never seen. There was a letter, for example, that basically the guy that wrote it, the real estate guy, said that they have every right to the, you know, the trailing under Senate Resolution 4277 or something. I think it was 4277. But then they wouldn't let the letter go out until it had gone to the attorneys and everybody and his brother. And by the time that that they were done, it suggested that he had no right under the 4277. So they were doing all this verbal manipulation or written manipulation to try and mitigate the position they'd taken with regard to all these things. And, you know, this, they just denied his rights. They denied him water for his cattle. They fenced out the water. He tore the fence down. They accused him of tearing the fence down. Yeah, he had a right to the water. So, I don't know. It's just crazy how abusive the government can be. And if you want some boring reading but intriguing, when you catch up on the story, the Harassment of the Hammonds is a series I wrote that's available on the blog. If you go to the blog, and is outpost-of-freedom.com/blog, all lowercase. And when you get to the blog, on a tab on the top, it'll say series listings. And there, since on the blog they came out chronologically, I made it easier for people to find the specific articles by, you know, going to that page, and then they see all 16 of the Bundy affairs, all 13 of the Liberty or Laws. The Harassment of the Hammonds was 12 articles. And then you can go through chronologically, and all the documents, in most cases, I've got links where you can download the documents that are referred to, whether it be a statute or a portion of the court case when I'm citing from a court decision. I think the only exception is I'm not allowed to use the transcripts of Massey's trial and sentencing hearing and pretrial hearing and an evidentiary hearing because of court restrictions. So I've taken excerpts from them, but I cannot provide the entire document. That would be a violation of the court order. But in every other case, the documentation is linked in the article, because I don't just read other people's articles and then call myself a researcher.
Right. You know, this is really good stuff, Gary, I got to tell you. And I just typed in outpost-of-freedom.com/blog, and this comes up. The latest one I see here is 28 September, and it's Burns Chronicles number 31, Public Lands Part 3, The Queen Has Ruled, Off With Their Heads. But this is this is really well-written stuff. And you know what? I want to go all the way back to something that you wrote in 2002. Murder American Style. And it's I'm just taking a piece here, but it's like, the U.S. government, in a zealous effort to protect its soldiers, has developed a method that is based upon intelligence. No, not the kind that demonstrates a superior knowledge. It is the far less reliable and often faulty intelligence gathered through whatever source it can pay for or coerce from other people. That's genius, because that seems to be, and we're talking 14 years ago when this was written. 14! And I got to tell you, when I read that, I thought, say, I think that's what the news media bases its stories on.
<You know>? Well, there's an article in, I brought it forward to the blog. See, a lot of things I wrote back on the .com page.
Yeah.
If you go there, there are paragraphs giving a brief and then a link to the page that covers it. But there's one that every once in a while I bring one forward from the old stuff into the blog. And there's one called The Prima Facie Story that I think demonstrates quite well the manipulation of the press. And once that prima facie story is out, regardless of how truthful, if it's disproven later, the prima facie story still stands. And that had to do with, I believe it was the train that was shot down in, or attacked in Kosovo or Yugoslavia. I forgot which one of our many wars we don't fight anymore.
Yeah.
Where they shot a passenger train and blew it off the tracks and killed a bunch of people. And the government said that they put out some video, and they said the pilot didn't have time when he realized it was a passenger train to not fire on it. Now, at the time I was watching it, there's a truck or a car going along a dirt road. And it looks like it's going awful fast and should be throwing up more dust than it is. But, you know, I don't have facts on that. But later the government acknowledged that they speeded up the film to make it look like that. But that never changed the news story on the story. The prima facie story was the pilot didn't have time to correct his mistake because the speeded up film, not because of the real circumstances. So when the truth comes out, the falsehood still remains as the prima facie story.
Gotcha. Well, I have enjoyed our conversation very much, sir, and I invite you to come back on, as these things are not going to go away magically and leave us nothing to talk about. I suspect they're going to get exponentially worse. Pretty much as you say, first we'll find out if the establishment Canada gets thrown out, and then we'll have to wait 6 months to see if the new anti-establishment candidate is actually going to do what he says, at which point, I remember what you said earlier, I don't think I'll repeat it now, just to, yes, I will. Go for the rifles.
I'll tell you what, retract that and I'll say it. Go for the rifles. We don't want to get you in trouble.
I didn't say it. He said it. And then I said, but that was after I said it. You know, it looks to me like maybe the only thing that's going to, you know, everybody wants a law or an initiative or something that'll solve everybody's problems so they can have what they want right now when they want it. And I'm thinking the only way to do that, of course,
knee-jerk legislation.
Yeah, something like that. But, it's too bad. You know, California, for example, is such a spectacularly beautiful state. It's just that the liberals pretty much took over L.A. and San Francisco, but you get out away from those towns a little bit and you find that people aren't liberal at all. But they don't seem to have the pull that the two big cities there have. San Diego.
Except
of course,
in one of the buildings in Sacramento, those got a lot of liberals in it.
Yeah, Sacramento, San Diego, the big cities. But, you know, there are a lot more people out away from those cities than inside those cities. And of course that state has, I mean, it has absolutely everything. So
it's beautiful. I was raised here. You know, when I got out of the army in 1967, I left, and then came back, back in 2001 when I had a job here.
Yeah.
And, but it changed so much. It is a beautiful state as long as you don't look at most of the people.
Well, I was thinking, you know, shouldn't we just like...
We used to go camping at Yosemite when I was a kid. My mother would take us up camping in Yosemite, my brother and I, and we'd both get to bring a friend. And Sequoia National Forest and many of the beaches. Geographically, it's a beautiful state.
Yeah.
And it has a lot to offer. But now they're curtailing water use because of some stupid little fish. That doesn't make sense to me. I have a problem with that.
Yeah, Well, it's probably better not to drink water anyway because of the disgusting things that fish do in water, but I digress. Look, here's the thing. I wonder if we're eventually going to have to split this country up into areas where the liberals go there, the conservatives go there, and the apoliticals can go there to the desert.
Well, let's go back again. You know, interestingly, when I read Supreme Court decisions, a lot of times I find things that I didn't expect to find. For example, Dred Scott v. Sanford had to do with slavery, but there are other aspects of that. One is the court can assume jurisdiction if nobody challenges, and the other one is a very lengthy description of who we the people are. And I've got an article, We the People, But Who Are We, that quotes from that. But there was another case that I was reading that was talking about voting, and except for two states where they said they didn't explain what they were, but all the states of the union then, and I think there were 17 states, maybe 20-something states, and they pointed out that every one of these states requires of voters to be, and that's in my recent article on Are You an Elector or a Voter, which is probably a bad title because it didn't get read as much as it should have. But all these states had requirements for voting. You had to be a freeman or a freeholder. That means you had to have an estate or you had to have a certain amount of wealth. And what we've got now, the Constitution, whenever it talks about voters, it says citizenship. All the amendments, the 15th Amendment, the women's right, the 18-year-old vote, the poll tax, all these talk about citizens of the United States. But the courts now are, the federal courts now are saying, you can't require proof of citizenship to vote, but the federal government's authority only extends to those that are citizens. But let's go to the citizens themselves. If you had to be a freeholder or a freeman, you've contributed to the country to some degree in building a country because you've owned something yourself. It varies from state to state how much you had to own or how much you rent you had to pay or how much wealth you had to have. But freeloaders weren't allowed to vote. But how many people do we have in this country, over 100,000, that are getting their primary source of revenue is coming from the government, not counting employees, is coming from the government? Welfare, housing assistance, all these other things. They shouldn't vote because they're going to vote to increase their dole. Where the people that built this country, like Donald Trump, or help build this country, like Donald Trump, they're going to vote with a concern over the success and perpetuation of the country. The others could care less if it destroys the country as long as they get their check every month. Mm-hmm. So when we look at voters, you know, the government really, they took away the poll tax, but they never took away the right of the states to evaluate. And this, in this day and age, that would be quite easy because of, you know, 1040s or the welfare rolls or the dole rolls. Anybody on a dole, except for government retirement systems and Social Security, every person on a dole should be exempt from voting. If they're receiving one penny in a given year, they should not be allowed to vote because they're going to vote to increase it. And then we would be building the country. And I don't know if Donald Trump's ever considered this, but I think he needs to, and he needs to work with Congress to let the states decide who can vote within their states. And that's the prerogative that was initially in the Constitution, that the electors will be selected from those that are qualified to vote for the most numerous house in the state. But then they've kind of stepped over that. And the federal government now is even going against themselves in terms of who can vote, not by legislation, but by judicial activism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, another solution is to allow people that have contributed to the United States of America, our country, that have made a contribution in one form or another just by their efforts. You know, if all they do is sling hot dogs, but they're not getting a paycheck from the government, then they should be allowed to vote. And if we cut those others off, I think we'd have probably no more than two blue states in the whole map.
Wow.
And California would be a red state, a Republican state at that point.
Yeah, and then there's the part about straightening out the Republicans and keeping them straightened out. But, oh, well, yeah.
Well, that's, yeah, another aspect, but that's I hope, in the works.
I do too, and I think I want to mention Trevor Loudon's film, The Enemies Within. I mentioned it at the beginning of the program, but I want to mention it again. And I've told people, and I tell them again, that if you already have a membership to Caravan to Midnight and you want to get something for somebody else, I'll tell you what you can do. You can join us for a year, which is the least expensive option by far, and get a copy of this movie for free. I mean, the shipping, the handling, the postage, all of that is just rolled into it. In fact, if you buy it from our site, we even save you a few cents. It's technically even less expensive than if you go to Trevor's site. But and he said he wanted to support us, and we appreciate him doing that. But here's the thing. We have something to offer besides the movie, and that is we'll give you the movie for free if you get a membership for somebody. You want to get two birds with one little pebble, and they still survive and are happier for it, then you get the membership for somebody, and you get the movie for somebody else that does have a membership. I mean, it's a good thing, so do it. Because when you see how many communists, I mean, hardcore, I mean, it's not like you're a communist. You know, like we used to call each other at school, call each other various things at school, you know, particularly in middle school, before we knew anything about anything. But these really are communists, and they really are in Congress, and they really are in various services in the country. And as long as this is happening, meaning they're allowed to remain there and not be exposed, then you're going to continue to see both parties, oh, we're going to take over the House, we're going to take over the Senate. They do, and then nothing happens. It doesn't matter who's in, nothing happens. The ship keeps sailing the same direction, and nothing gets fixed. People want things fixed. Well, they're fixed, all right. Fixed meaning stuck. So if you want to find out why, you get this picture. And if you want to read some really interesting articles, then you need to go to outpostoffreedom.com. And be sure and put dashes between the words, or you won't get it. Outpost-of-freedom.com/blog for an additional site. By the way, I have not been able to figure out, Gary, if there is a link to go to the blog from the regular site.
Yes, there is. Right at the top, some of the recent or more expansive articles, and a rather interesting radio one too. This is we were talking about Oklahoma City and the Wayne had mentioned the co-conspirators. I was John Doe 4, by the way.
I got you.
At least according to Bill Cooper. Mm-hmm. And so we finally refuted that a few years ago in a radio program with Larry Beecraft as the guest that was with me April 19th, 1995 in Orlando, Florida, which means I couldn't have been the guy they claim I was in Oklahoma City at the time, or as Larry said, unless I had a transporter. But I do want to put a plug in, too. I think I mentioned this to you before the show started, that Kevin Massey in prison at Segoville, Texas, federal penitentiary, he and a large group of people every Sunday night listen to Caravan to Midnight and love the show.
Oh, that's fantastic. You know, I used to say, it says in the Bible, visit people who are incarcerated. You know, and I used to, when I was on Coast to Coast, I used to say, you know, for those in hospital, for those in prison, we visit you. And, there are a lot of people in prison. Isn't it funny? The ones who...
should be.
what was it Walter said? Whoever it was that made this Pop-Tart is the one who should be in jail. It's like you have people in jail for absolutely nothing at all compared to the monstrous atrocities and crimes that are foisted on the American people every day. Or like Michael said in the movie Heat, I did time for what that guy does every day. And that's really true, so I got to tell you.
Well, let's look at this thing with Trump and the 11-year-old video now, too. my feeling is the guy that should apologize is the guy that went public with a private conversation. But the press is misdirecting it. They're blaming Trump for what this guy did. And apparently the guy has been suspended at where he works, because he disclosed information that was not that's owned by the company, and so he'll probably lose his job over it. But he's the bad guy.
Yeah, he is. I mean, why would you do something like that except to make your wanky little self into some sort of a temporary star, get yourself fired, and be forgotten after what you did caused a big furor, and then it amounted to nothing in the end? I think it's pathetic. I really do. Why would you do something like that? Why hold on to something like that for 11 years and then let it out?
Yeah.
Because they thought he was going to run for president in a little over a decade, well, really?
It'd be interesting to see what happened to his bank account when he let it out, and it would be interesting to see who contributed to that bank account when it came out.
I wonder if he has a foundation, Gary. He does now, right?
Yeah, in his position, I don't think he does, but I wouldn't be surprised. Quite frankly, I wouldn't be surprised if it came back to the Republican Party.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Yeah, well, those people are...
And I think that'll come out in the next week or two. I'm sure that it's being looked into very closely right now.
Well, we got to talk again sometime in the near future. It's going to get... I don't think it's going to get more boring as time goes by. I think it's going to get way more interesting. So let's make sure...
Well, if we get into the Burns Chronicles and go from A to Z on that, you know, we can kill a couple hours right there. The specific stories themselves are intriguing, I think, and you know that's why I cover them, and I try and make them more intriguing by my presentation. But I mean, that's my effort to move people along that thin line, is to get them to understand. And I appreciate coming on your show to do what both of us want to see done: people to understand what is really happening in this country.
Yeah, you know, the thing is nobody's looking, between the two of us sitting here, nobody's looking for a big paycheck or a big payoff. We were raised with some semblance of values, maybe even a little morality, and we just don't like injustice. We don't like watching it. We don't like seeing people crushed beneath the weight of the government over nothing except their own greed. And you say, well, greed, they're the government. It's like there are individuals within the government who are getting huge payoffs for this. Why do you think nobody leaves Congress or government service in general at the Capitol level that isn't rich? Nobody leaves there without being a multimillionaire. Nobody. Why is that, everybody? You know why. Gary, thank you.
Thank you, John.
Talk again soon, sir.
Okay.
Wow. It's good to have a laid-back conversation with a laid-back guy out in the laid-back state of California, particularly Northern California. And we will speak with him again, I have no doubt. Well, so how about that ridiculous debate? I thought it was pretty good. Isn't it funny? The left is so vicious about everything. Yeah. But when you hit them back, they go, you're so mean. I got to do it one more time. I can't hit a lady. I just can't. She's going, don't hit me, Johnny. Shh, be still. Shut up. Be seeing you.